The DACA program remains intact. Hello and welcome to this Pledge Drive edition of Sundial. I'm Chris Remington, filling in for Luis Hernandez. The Obama-era program shielding hundreds of thousands of people from deportation has faced years of legal challenges from the Trump administration. How will the program evolve under President-elect Biden? Plus, students in Miami-Dade County are getting fresh produce from school gardens during the pandemic from an unexpected carrier, self-driving cars. We'll learn about the new program at two area schools. Finally,
they want to come play at your club, and they'll be like, what? Like, classical? This is a nightclub. What are you talking about? Get out of here, you know?
Black violin are breaking stereotypes, blending classical violin with hip-hop and inspiring students to pursue careers in music. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Chris Remington, filling in for Luis Hernandez, and thank you for your support during this winter membership campaign. Hundreds of thousands of children of immigrants across the U.S. will not be at risk of deportation following a recent court ruling. A New York federal judge ruled the Obama-era program known as DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, will remain intact. Now newly eligible immigrants can apply. This is the latest in a string of unsuccessful legal challenges by the Trump administration to terminate DACA. I spoke earlier this morning with WLRN's Latin America correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, when does this new ruling take effect?
Well, it's supposed to take effect this week. The federal judge in New York ordered the Trump administration to have everything ready on the Homeland Security website by yesterday, Monday. And so this is a pretty immediate ruling.
And so does that mean people can start applying now?
Yes. In fact, we could see as many as 300,000 new applicants come into the arena here.
And give us a sense of who can apply, who is eligible for the DACA program.
It's essentially anyone under the age of 31 as of June 15th, 2012. That's the most basic eligibility requirement. They have to have come to the U.S. under the age of 16, and they have to have continuously resided in the U.S. since June 15th of 2007. Now, the other important eligibility requirements are that they have to either be in school currently, or they have to have graduated from high school and have a GED, or they have to be in the military or have been honorably discharged from the military. So that's sort of the matrix there.
And do we have a sense of how many DACA recipients are living here in Florida?
Well, Florida has the fourth highest number of DACA recipients. We have about 75,000. The highest number is California, not surprisingly, with 425,000. And then New York and Illinois have the second and third highest number.
And what does the makeup look like of those DACA recipients living here? What types of countries are folks coming from, their families?
It's a pretty broad distribution. We have DACA recipients here, for example, in Homestead, quite a few young Mexican DACA recipients. But I would say probably the lion's share are from Central America and South America, quite a few Colombian DACA recipients here in South Florida, for example.
And do we have a sense of how large their impact is on the economy here?
It is quite large, according to Democrats in Congress, who recently put out a study showing that more than 90% of dreamers, as DACA recipients are called in this country, are employed. 93% over the age of 25 are employed. Their average salary is about $36,000. But more importantly, this study suggests that if these dreamers were to be deported, it would cost the U.S. economy about $60 billion. It could reduce economic growth in the United States by about $280 billion. These DACA recipients, they pay, for example, about $1.4 billion in federal taxes, about $2 billion in Social Security taxes, and about 5 to 10% of them have started small businesses. So they really are a significant portion right now of economic growth.
Definitely. And this latest court ruling was really the latest in a slew of a number of challenges by the Trump administration over the past 4 years. They could appeal this particular ruling, but is that likely?
Anything has been likely with the Trump administration on this issue. They have been fighting this quite doggedly because it's what President Trump's political base wants. But now that President Trump is a lame duck, I and given how long the appeal process would take, I think even the Trump administration might decide at this point that it's impractical to pursue further appeals on this.
And then, of course, there's Joe Biden, who spoke very little on the campaign trail about immigration. What do we know about what changes might be in store for DACA once he's in office?
Well, I think that we can count on Joe Biden to restore DACA as it was under President Obama, who created DACA with an executive action back in 2012. The problem is, at this point, the more important consideration is, what do we do in the long run with DACA recipients? Sure, we give them these temporary work authorizations and protection from deportation, but now the consideration is, what do we do to give them permanent legal standing, permanent legal residency? And that's something I think that that's going to have to happen in Congress, and that's going to be the sticking point. Can Joe Biden convince Congress to take on this kind of immigration reform? And boy, that's just not looking likely right now. A lot of it could depend on how these two Senate races in Georgia go.
Yeah, I was going to ask, if Democrats have control of the House and the Senate, does that seem possible, even considering during Obama's time, Democrats had control of the House?
Well, the one thing, if they do have control of Congress that way, the one thing they do have in their favor is that surveys show 3/4 of Americans do favor giving DACA recipients, giving the Dreamers permanent legal standing. Most Americans are very sympathetic to their plight, since they were brought here as kids under no fault of their own.
And how do you think things might change for immigration as a whole, thinking of some of the bigger policy issues once President-elect Biden takes office?
Well, aside from the Dreamers, again, that's going to be hard. Aside from the Dreamers, immigration reform is just sort of a non-starter with Republicans. And given the fact that half the country voted for President Trump, it's going to be very hard for Biden to execute sort of a more comprehensive immigration reform package apart from this Dreamers consideration.
That was WLRN's Latin America correspondent, Tim Padgett. You can read more about the latest DACA ruling by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Still to come, virtual schooling has disrupted classroom gardening programs. We'll learn how autonomous vehicles are providing a solution. But first, if our coverage on issues like immigration, technology, and the arts are important to you, why don't you show your support so we can continue programs like this one? Here's how. Welcome back to this Pledge Drive edition of Sundial. I'm Chris Remington, filling in for Luis Hernandez. For thousands of students choosing to learn from home this fall, it isn't just the in-person learning kids are missing. There's the band practice, theater, sports, and every extracurricular in between that's been forced to evolve because of the pandemic. Through the Education Fund's Food Force for Schools program, students normally have the opportunity to learn and see how fresh produce grows. And then that produce is incorporated into daily school lunches. Now, students at Feinberg Fisher K-8 Elementary on Miami Beach and Riverside Elementary in Little Havana can access this fresh produce through Ford's autonomous vehicle program. It's simple. The food is picked up by a self-driving car from the garden and then delivered to homes through contactless drop-offs. I spoke with Deborah LaBelle, the manager for the Food Force program, also Alex Busnego, the Miami market manager for Ford Autonomous Vehicles. When did you notice a need for students to get access to fresh produce that they normally get in schools but have been unable to because of this pandemic?
Well, at the start of the school year, when the students were still virtual, the teachers were contacting me and telling me that the students were communicating on their online lessons that they were missing the food forest, and they missed being outside and being able to eat the greens that they were used to eating when they were at school.
And can you tell us a little bit, for folks that aren't familiar with the Food Forest program, what this looks like? This isn't your typical backyard garden. You guys have all kinds of stuff growing there.
Yeah, no, we take an area of the school and we turn all of the landscaping becomes edible. So there are trees, such as, acerola cherries or Barbados cherries, and bushes and the ground cover and the herbs, everything in the air, every plant in the area is all edible. So the students really are used to going out there and just picking leaves off of plants and eating them.
So Alex, let's bring you in. Where did the idea to come in, use self-driving cars to deliver the produce?
Yeah, absolutely. So Ford's been in Miami since 2018, and a part of our work is launching business pilot programs to learn the business of what it is to move passengers or to deliver goods. And when we were planning our next pilot program around the delivery of goods, we said, you know, it's been a tough year for a lot of reasons for students and families and teachers and schools in our community. So why not determine if there would be a way to accomplish our objectives while also doing good for the community? And so we went down the hall, if you will, to our colleagues at the Ford Motor Company Fund and asked if there were any organizations in Miami that you know, might have a need for something like that. And we were quickly connected to the Education Fund, an organization that Ford has partnered with for many, many years, and the rest was history.
And to be clear, for those who don't live in Miami or haven't seen the self-driving cars, this is a pilot program where you do still have folks in the vehicles. You're not going to pull up to a self-driving car with no one in it, but essentially they're there to take over in case there are any issues. Can you sort of explain how the program works?
Yeah, that sounds good. I'll take a small step back. So Miami has a pretty special place in Ford Motor Company's heart. For just about 3 years now, Ford has been in Miami. Miami was chosen as the first city globally to test self-driving vehicles and to build our business around self-driving vehicles. So this has consisted of two parallel paths, the first of which is the technology itself and building what we call the self-driving system. So to your point, this work is being done with the utmost focus on safety, and there are two test specialists in the vehicle, two safety drivers, you know, attentively looking at the environment around and ensuring that the system is doing what it's supposed to do. The second parallel path is to build the business. And so, as I mentioned, we're doing a series of pilot programs to understand what it's like to run a business that will leverage self-driving vehicles in a service format.
Debbie, I wanted to bring you back in now that we've talked about how the system works for the driverless vehicles. Tell us about how this drop-off with the produce works.
Yeah, so we have our teachers at the school, and they identified some families that could use some extra assistance and some produce and school supplies that could be delivered to the students that were learning virtually. And we contacted those families and asked if they would sign up. And so weekly we go to the school, we harvest a big bag of the produce that's being grown right at the school. And the Education Fund also has a warehouse for educational supplies. So we also have been putting in composition books and pencils and needed school supplies along with the produce and sending it. And then we give it to the Ford drivers, and the drivers deliver it to each of these students' houses.
And what have you heard from parents or from the students about what it means to get this food dropped off and get it dropped off from a driverless car at that?
They're really excited. You know, we've received multiple photos from the parents. We've been in contact with the different families and just making sure that everything that we're sending home is very valuable to them. And they've been sending us pictures of the different meals that they're making using the greens, and we've seen salads. And actually just this morning, somebody sent a picture of some black beans that they cooked with bay leaves that we were growing at the school. So it's really fun to see how that everything is being used and to know that it's being worthwhile and valued.
No, that sounds delicious. And Alex, you were alluding to this earlier. I want to come back to it. You know, we know companies like Uber have invested heavily into self-driving cars because, as you mentioned, they see the potential for food delivery service to expand. So for Ford, do you see this as part of sort of the future of the autonomous vehicle fleet, or is this more of a one-time experiment, this idea of delivering products to folks as a business or as a nonprofit?
Yeah, absolutely. Ford's intention with its self-driving business is to both move passengers and to move goods. And so the work we're doing today in the years leading up to our launch in 2022 is a series of pilot programs to sort of evaluate the different business models and also to study the customer experience and determine kind of what categories of goods, you know, people have a need for and people best respond to. So the pilot programs we do are largely around studying the customer experience and the business model.
That was Deborah LaBelle, Program Manager for the Education Fund Food Forests, and Alex Bosnego, the Miami Market Manager for Ford Autonomous Vehicles. We've posted more on this unique pilot program on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Still to come, a message of positivity and defying stereotypes. We introduce you to the duo Black Violin. But first, is public radio as much a part of your morning routine as your cup of coffee? Do you need it to start the day? If so, why don't you consider contributing for the service that you rely on day in and day out? Here's how you can do it. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Chris Remington, filling in for Luis Hernandez. And thank you for your support during this winter membership campaign. You're listening to Stereotypes from the duo Black Violin from Fort Lauderdale. Wilner Baptiste and Kevin Marcus have been defying stereotypes their entire career. They've been playing together for the last 15 years after meeting in high school. And since then, they've won live at the Apollo, performed on the Today Show, and for thousands of area schools. Their latest album is a holiday special called Give Thanks. The group is launching season 3 of Live from the 305, a special series here at WLRN where we highlight the artists that are shaping the South Florida music scene. I spoke with Kevin Will last week. You can see photos and video of the group on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Kevin Will, let's start. Take me back in time to Dillard High School, the Performing Arts in Fort Lauderdale. Why were you both compelled to join the orchestra and play classical music? What was the inspiration?
Well, I got to go back a few more years before we get to Dillard. I wanted to play the saxophone, and they put me in the wrong class. True story. And I didn't find out till 2012. It was actually the band teacher and the orchestra teacher had a bet, and they said, whoever wins this golf game gets this kid in their class. And that's how they – yes, that's how I got into that class. But then, you know – after middle school, I went to high school and met Kev. I was a freshman. He was a sophomore, and we were stand partners. I was first chair. He was second or third. Who knows? Anyway, it was a different environment, man. Our high school was very vibrant and artistic, and literally, man, there's after rehearsal doing fifth grade, there's a rock band playing in this little, I don't even know what it was, Kev. It was like this really vibrant little section that the rock band would rehearse. And, you know, it was just so dope.
And Kev, maybe you can jump in and tell us a little bit more about the school for folks that aren't familiar with it. Like, do you have to come in an audition to get in? Are these all kids that have studied and sort of have a background in music or performing arts?
Well, Dillard's in Fort Lauderdale. It's you know, it's a magnet program. When we went there, you had to audition. I'm pretty sure you still do. But everyone in the county, in Broward County, has access to the school. It's very central. So, you know, when we went there, there would be people that lived in Parkland and people that lived in Hollandale that go there and just bus in to get to the school. And now there's when we went there back in the 90s, it was a performing arts school and it had like, you know, orchestra room and a choir. But now it's like a center of performing arts.
And Will, you had mentioned hip hop, and I definitely want to talk about your hip hop influences. But I'm curious, like, did y'all grow up listening to classical music at all? Was that at all part of your like childhood, or was this something you guys got more exposed to at Dillard?
Definitely not. Not growing up, you know. I think classical music and just the instrument itself was just so far away. It just felt far away. You know, it was never something that I felt like I was, I could be a part of or attainable, to be honest, you know? And, so that's one of the reasons why, to me, you know, when I picked it up and I started playing it and my teachers were just like, man, you're pretty good. You can go to college for free with this. And I was just like, really? Okay, well, I guess I'll keep playing it, you know. but it really never felt like it, you know, I belong, you know what I mean? But I think hip hop was everything, you know, and being able to express ourselves with this instrument was the reason why we kept playing. And we grew up in the 90s, so hip hop was just so vibrant, you know what I mean? Like the artists from the Tupac to Biggie, and just, you know, it was just really, really, really great time, you know?
You know, I was going to ask about that because I'm thinking Miami specifically, you got Two Live Crew with Luther Campbell. You've got that Miami bass sound. Right. Like, is that at all sort of grounded in your hip hop background and sort of what you grew up with?
Absolutely.
Yeah, oh, yeah, completely. You know, if you listen to like any of our stuff, you know, I mean, we're, you know, not to say Southern, but yeah, like Miami bass type, you know, beats, you know, we're known mostly, if you think of like all of our, you know, big songs, like A Flat or Stereotypes, or, you know, those are all like kind of like Miami bass. And then on the new album we have called Give Thanks, we have a Joy to the World that's very much that, you know, just like, you know, it's this, you know, really nice melody on top, but Miami bass on the bottom, because we just kind of keep coming back to it. And I think it's, you know, we grew up in the 90s, like Doo-Doo Brown and, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's just in us.
Yeah, and I think one of the tracks, going back to one of your early original albums, the song Inspiration really strikes me because you've got the R&B vocals, you've got an edgy beat, and you've also got a beautiful violin.
Gotta really look back at that one. That one came about where I think I made this beat. I took this string sample that I found somewhere, and I made a quick little beat to it. And a lot of times when I started writing like actual songs, it was really just poems that I would write. And I remember being in high school, my English teacher really got me into writing poems. I remember her name was Miss Latimer, actually. She would have us just like write poems and stuff, you know what I mean? And I was just, it was weird for me, because I'm like, what do you mean, write what I feel? And I was just, she was like, yeah, just write whatever you feel, you know? And I started really getting into that. And in college, I used to do that a lot, just writing poems and stuff. And that's kind of what I used to do. And that song was actually just like a poem that I wrote, and I just kind of converted into songs. And my early writing was that.
No, it is really beautiful, and something that's great about it, and so much of your music is about mixing genres. And I'm curious, like early on when you guys were starting out, did you get pushback from record label producers or publicists or folks that are like, yo, there's not going to be a market for this, like people aren't going to be interested in sort of this mixed genre that you guys are doing?
Yeah, you know, whenever people have never heard something before, they're skeptical, even if they like it. They're like, well, other people like it? I don't know. I mean, there's no track record proving anything, you know? So I think, yeah, there was some pushback. You know, just think about, we were going down Collins or going to, you know, Ocean, and, you know, and back in the day, like Teasers was there, like, or Levels, different clubs. And we were like, hey, you know, we got these hip hop, you know, violin players. They want to come play at your club and rock out rock out for everybody in your club. And they'll be like, what? Like classical? This is a nightclub. What are you talking about? Get out of here, you know? So the idea of it, trying to convince people of the idea of it, and before YouTube or Twitter or Facebook or any sort of visual medium that you just pull out of your pocket, you walk up to somebody who's never heard anything like this before. You say, I got these two black guys that play violin and they want to come and rock out of your nightclub. It sounds ridiculous, you know?
And I got to jump in there. So you guys started playing clubs on Miami Beach? Like, that just blows
my
mind.
Wow. That's how we started. That's how the whole idea came about, because we were producing, we had these artists, and, you know, our artists, you know, we'd play in the background of our artists, and people were like, what's going on with those two big black dudes in the back playing violin? And for us, we were just trying to make beats and, you know, be a record label and be the next Timbaland or Neptunes. We wanted to be the next super producers.
One of the other things that I really appreciate about your music that came through in this most recent album, but really through all of your work, is this message of spreading positivity and fighting stereotypes. And one song that really speaks to that is called Dreamer.
This is the time that I make my own heart. Gonna reach up my hands and
I know this might be tough. I asked you to go back in the past, but this song really took me back to when I was a kid and what I was dreaming about and envisioned for my life. So I'm kind of curious for both of y'all, like if you were to go back in time to when you were kids, what you dreamt for yourselves and if this is like part of that dream.
Yeah, I mean, it's never could really imagine and dreamt this. And it's the thing too, that I think that really the passion for playing for kids is, I think that's where it stems from, because when I was younger, real talk, I wanted to be a carpenter, you know, because I used to watch my dad build things, you know what I'm saying? I was like, I want to do that, you know what I'm saying? As I got older, I don't know, because they don't seem like they pay too much for carpenters, you know, I want to maybe something else. But the thing about it is exposing kids to different things and allowing them to see greatness within themselves and other people, it's just so crucial, man. And you know, without really playing this instrument and being able to travel and being able to see different things and just being exposed to different things, man, it just allows you to dream. And then when you grow and you're moving forward and you put the work in, like Kev said, and it's like, okay, it's not surprising that you know, your hard work is being paid off.
No, I'm so glad you brought up the work that you both do with children. That's so critical in terms of touring to schools around the country. And I'm wondering if you've had an experience at a school in South Florida or elsewhere, especially now during COVID times where you can't travel to schools, that really resonates with you, that like sticks with you, either a student conversation that you had or a teacher, but that's, you know, resonates with you now when you're not able to see these kids in face to face.
A particular you know, I mean, I would say, you know, it's not necessarily in school, but there were these students, you know, of ours, not even students of ours. We were playing a show like way back. We had just won Apollo. We're playing at the Caleb Theater in Liberty City. And I don't know, this is like maybe 2004, 2003. And I remember we played the show, you know, we were just like kind of on a high a little bit, come out. And there was a guy and he was sitting there. And then he said, hey, you know, my two sons, they love you guys. And they study with the same person who gave you the violin, Ann Fallick, you know, who was my first teacher at Parkway Middle School. And he was like, would you like to meet him? And I remember I walked over to him and I met him. And I was like, hey, you know, got to meet them. And they're like 9 and 11, something like that. And they're like, you know, so I meet them and then, like, you know, and they're like, I talked to them a little bit. And I was like, you know what? All you guys got to do to be like us is practice, practice, practice. Right. And then fast forward maybe like 7 or 8 years later, and we're playing at the Miramar Cultural Center. And the promoter is like, oh, we got this opener, these two guys that play violin. And I was like, ah, you know, and they, at the time we didn't know who they were. I was like, I don't want any violinists opening before us, please. Like, we like to be the first violins on the stage. Like, oh, we already told them. And their dad knows too. And the dad's here. And I'm like, and their kids, I'm like, oh, okay. All right, cool. You know, and just sort of in a sense of artistically, you know, we want to be the first different violin thing you hear. Like, so then, you know, they go on and then I'm sitting on the side of the stage and they are nice. They're so good with it. And at the end of it, he goes and he says, you know, it's such an honor. The youngest one says, it's such an honor to be here. And I remember talking to Kev 8 years ago and he said, practice, practice, practice. And I just started crying. I was like, oh, I was like bawling because I'm like, yo, and now they, and at that time, now they go to Dillard High School. You know, they study with like our high school kids. So it's like all full circle. You know, you could just plant that one seed and then next thing you know, something amazing grows. So we take it very, very seriously.
So let's Let's talk about this new album, the special holiday album, Give Thanks. You guys really get creative with this one, and only Black Violin can do. Let's take a listen to Sugar Plum Fairy. So I gotta ask, what was the process for putting together this album that's honestly unlike anything I've heard? How did you guys do it your way and give it sort of that Black Violin feel?
We walked into the studio, and I kid you not, we walked in the studio in January, and when we walked in, we said, we want to make a Christmas album that you could play in July. That was what the idea, like, how do we make a holiday album, holiday feel, but you could literally play it any time of the year, you know?
Let me end on this one, because it is the theme, Give Thanks. This year has been difficult for so many. What are you guys thankful for?
Oh, man. Whew. Where do I start? You know, I'm thankful for family, friends. I'm thankful for just life, you know what I'm saying? Being able to live. I mean, you know, there's so many people hurting right now. Like, sometimes I go on Facebook and people are just outpouring, just like, you know, they're going through it, right? And I look at my life and I'm like, you know, obviously I know a lot of people that have been affected by the pandemic and COVID. But it's just like, man, you got to be thankful. You're here. You know what I'm saying? I got my kids in the background screaming, but they're here, you know?
I'm thankful for this brother, Will, that's on this Zoom, this radio call with me as well. I'm thankful for, you know, my family. You know, this year I got to think a lot about the sacrifices they made because I got to spend so much time with them, you know. I haven't left my house. I haven't left on an aircraft since March 8th, which is an eternity for, you know, me and my family. So I got to just get so much closer with them and also understand the sacrifices that they make, you know, for us to do this. So I'm thankful for them. Thankful for our fans that supported us through all these albums and, you know, come out and check us out in all these cities. I'm thankful for everybody that's been there along the way, for all our teachers, for everybody. Thankful for everyone that is open to be inspired by what we do. I think I just give thanks, you know, every day.
That was Will Baptiste and Kev Marcus. They make up Black Violin. Again, you can see photos and videos of them performing on our social at WLRN Sundial. And stay tuned. Next year, we'll bring you more of Season 3 of Live from the 305. And that's Sundial for Tuesday, December 8th. We don't have a show tomorrow because of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting, but we're back on Thursday, and WLRN's Morning Edition host Christine DiMatte will take the hosting reins. We'll be speaking with noted Jewish actor and cultural historian Avi Hoffman about the start of Hanukkah. Plus, The Man Who Stole Christmas, a major motion picture, is coming to the Seminole Theater. It's being adapted for a virtual production. I'm Chris Remington. Thank you so much for listening. I'll talk to you again on Thursday. But first, a reminder, in order to continue bringing you shows like this one, we need support from people like you. Here's how you can donate.